the Zionist regime that was, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago is starting to be shattered. And I wanted to just bring proof that came to my mind when this was being spoken about was the fact that the Zionist regime is losing the psychological, the physical, the military, and the soft war. And how, what is the proof that they're losing is the fact that they have had to go and normalize relations with these Arab regimes.
Sorry, I didn't.
Right, exactly. I'm totally turning the tables here.
Okay.
Okay. The Zionist regime never needed any Arab regime to normalize with them.
I was going to make this point. It's
right.
Interesting that he brings
okay.
up now.
Right?
Plot
they
twist.
Never needed to. Right? They were so proud and arrogant and in everybody's face. We don't need the United States. Ariel Sharon famously used to say this.
Uh-huh.
Ariel Sharon, right? The big fat guy, right? Right? The killer of Palestinians. And this guy was really, he was killer of Palestinians, and they enjoyed killing Palestinians, Ariel Sharon, right? And who was in a coma for a long time before he died. This is punishment of God. You know, most probably. Anyways, this guy used to openly say, we don't care about America. We own America.
Really?
Right? Mm. Okay, so this is what the arrogant Zionist regime used to be. Look at it now. Look at how weak they have become. Look at how lowly and humiliated they have become that they have had to go to who? They've had to go to the UAE, the milking goat. As Abdul Malik al-Houthi say, to normalize ties with them in order to support their regime.
So in other words, they're now seeking legitimacy. See, this, these are the... Because they feel threatened. They know. This is an entity that believed in expansionism, right?
Yeah.
The Zionist regime, its motto was to expand from Niles to Euphrates.
That's something right? I want to bring up in the next episode, inshallah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now they have built walls around themselves. This is how insecure they are.
Wow. Okay.
They're scared.
Somebody who believes in expansionism, you don't build walls, right? Expansionism means you break walls, right? They were forced to build walls around them so they could stay, right? And now, diplomatically too, they are seeking legitimacy from these so-called Arab dictators, right? And these Arab rulers and whatnot. Why? Because they feel that they're alone in this world. When you go to United Nations and you have any resolution against them, right? Look at the countries who support Israel and look at the countries who are against Israel. You're like, well, United Nations, which is also controlled by the world powers, even there, they don't have any support.
Right, yeah, yeah.
From the world governments. People, we said, the entire world, I can safely say, the entire world does not like the existence of Israel. They don't want to deal with this cancerous tumor, right? Whether they know it right now or not. But they're not a fan of Israel, to say the least, right? But when you go to these so-called international platforms like United Nations Security Council, you see that these resolutions, they are opposed. The resolutions that are in favor of Israel are opposed by the world governments, and the resolutions that are against Israel are supported by the world governments, except for the United Nations and those who they can control forcefully.
Yeah.
Right? And this is governments. We said people are against them anyways. So they're feeling insecure. Now they're looking for these securities and these, you know, straws to just hang on to while they're drowning, and they know it.
So we've kind of run out of time, but there's just one question I'd like to raise here, because one of the things that we see is Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, you know, one of the great revolutionary icons that we have in today's world. He said that, you know, I think it was back in the year 2000, where he was urging the Arab nations and the Arab leaders not to normalize ties with Israel, and now we see it happening. But now you guys are talking about the weakness of Israel, and you've already kind of, this is a huge plot twist, because you're actually showing that all these things, if we look at it from a different perspective, actually it's showing how weak they are, not how strong they are.
Yes.
And it's one of the statements of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, where he says, Wallahi, hiya ahwanu min baytil ankabut. I swear by Allah, she, or Israel, is weaker than the spider's web. And I've heard this before, and I was like, but this is starting to shed more light on it. If it really is so weak, though, why has it not been destroyed already?
Well, this is where, and I think it requires a little elaboration, but I think since we're short on time, I'll keep it short. it would have been very easy to just completely annihilate and demolish and destroy the Zionist regime, Israel, militarily. But the point is that we believe in the support of the masses before anything like that happens. We don't want to leave out the masses, because at the end of the day, we have the popular support. We have the support of the public. We don't want to lose it. So this means that we have to prepare the masses for that day.
Subhanallah.
Once the masses are prepared for that day, it's just going to happen inevitably. We don't have to, like, you know, we're not in a rush. This is something we need to understand. There's no rush. We don't want to do it overnight and then, you know, explaining to the whole world why we did it and then, you know. No, we are in no rush. We are going to wait for people to get prepared. And this is where the role of preachers come into the play. They have to prepare the masses for that day. And it's going to happen, inshallah.
That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. It's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah, Allah.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question which is very important, which is very principal and instrumental in the Islamic faith, and that is the question of how we can reconcile the belief that God is the sole creator of all things with the belief that we intuitively feel is correct, that there are other agents and causes in this world besides God. These two seem to be apparently incompatible with one another. The answer to this question is that these two beliefs are not incompatible with one another. It's possible to reconcile them with one another. And the way we do that is this. When the Quran says that God is the creator of all things, it means that God is the only being in this universe that can independently and essentially create something. This doesn't negate the idea that things can create and produce certain effects with the power that God has given them. If we wanted to use Quranic terminology here, we would say that it doesn't negate the idea that things can be the agents and causes of certain effects, bi-iznillah, with the permission of God. This concept of bi-iznillah, or with the permission of God, is a Quranic term, which essentially means what we just mentioned, that if these things produce these effects, it's through the blessings and through the bounties and through the power that God has graced them with. So therefore, these two beliefs are not incompatible with one another. If they're incompatible with one another, it's only at face value. Otherwise, they are not incompatible with one another. There's many verses in the Holy Quran which simultaneously affirm creation for God and his effects as well. For example, in Surah Rum, verse 48, Allah says the following, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Allahu alladhi yursilu riyaha fatusiru sahaban. God is the one who sent the winds, and by means of the winds, he scattered the clouds. Or in another verse, Surah An-Nur, verse 43, God says the following, أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يُزْجِي سَحَابًا ثُمَّ يُؤَلِّفُ بَيْنَهُ ثُمَّ يَجْعَلُهُ رُكَامًا. Don't you see that God is the one who mixes the clouds or combines them? So in this verse, he simultaneously ascribes this effect to himself and to his creatures as well. In one case, he ascribes the scattering of the clouds to winds, and in another place, he ascribes it to himself. Or, for example, in the production of the shafts of wheat, sometimes God relates this effect to the seed, which is planted in the ground. For example, in Surah Baqarah, verse 261, God says, وَأَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ. In another verse, he ascribes it to himself. For example, in Surah Naml, in verse 60, he says, وَأَنْزَلَ لَكُمْ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً فَأَنْبَتْنَا بِهِ حَدَائِقَ ذَاتَ بَهْجَةٍ. He ascribes it to himself in this verse. So therefore, these two beliefs are not irreconcilable and compatible with one another. They can be combined in the way that we talked about today in this program. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
And thank you very much for coming. So the question says, how can useful and comprehensive training of children be done? What are the aspects that we should consider during training our children?
That's a good question, because many parents, they want to train nicely their children, you know, but they don't know in what regard do they train their children. So here, inshallah, we will look at some of the aspects that need to be considered while carrying out and having the best results in the process.
Okay.
So one of them is guidance. Guidance is one aspect that you should really look out whilst nurturing your children.
Okay.
So a child must be guided towards what is right, of course, from a young age. This includes teaching him of the beliefs and actions of religion.
Yes.
This includes good manners. This includes moral and social values. This includes the adab and the etiquette that a child needs to have, the good manners, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the child should be taught about the healthy ways of living, having good relationships with others, living a useful life in terms of helping and serving others, not being selfish. So this type of training is done through talking to the child.
Okay.
You know, talking to the child is so important that a mother has this, for example, capability of doing. She's always with the child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she, a woman can more relate and express herself than a man.
Sure.
So a woman should talk to the child and show a good example. You know, for example, she can also, whilst guiding the child, if talking is, for example, not enough, or there comes an age that you need to send the child to, for example, an institute to learn. So send the child to in places like madrasas, learning institutes, involving the child with religious community and awareness of the Muslim ummah at large, you know. So this is as per guidance.
All right.
So the age and ability of the child must be kept in mind also here. Parents can use the help of teachers. They can also sometimes use help of relatives to guide the children, community members to guide the children, books to guide the children, and other useful resources for this aspect of training, that is the guidance part.
Yes.
So the guidance part in everything, the worldly guidance and the hereafter guidance, you know, how to go about in every way, you know, like physically, socially, mentally, emotionally, guiding the child. That's one aspect that the mother has the goal to achieve, that I want to guide my child from when they're young to they're old, to when they get of age. Another aspect that is very important is self-control. This is one thing that will also help them a long way. If you go and see, even if we don't look at it religiously, self-control is one thing that helps them even in, you know, in their affairs in this world.
Okay.
You know, in how to cope in this world with the people. Self-control. A child should be taught that a human being is different from an animal. The value of the akal shouldn't be underestimated, you know. The intellect is something that Allah granted only the human with.
All right. Should we continue on this point after the break?
Yes.
Stay tuned, dear listeners. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, this is Salma Khalfan. We were talking about the aspects of training, and one of them was guidance, and the second was self-control, as to we have to teach them how to
control themselves so that they can also cope with in their lives, spiritual lives,
mm-hmm.
their physical lives as well. So the value of this mind shouldn't be underestimated, the akal.
Yes.
And the child must learn to control his desires and wants. Mm. And that's why a parent is told that, you know, don't spoil a child by giving them everything they want.
Yeah. Yes.
He must learn to control himself. He must learn to control some of his emotions also.
Mm.
Like what? His anger, his jealousy, and, you know, like greed, selfishness. All this will, you're teaching him to self-control, learn self-control. And it's the duty of the parents to deal with these emotions and help the child to control them.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a child is jealous, then you can talk to the child and tell him, you know, like, who is the giver of the ni'mat of all these things, you know, to certain people.
Okay,
you don't need to be jealous of, you need to pray that Allah gives you more than that.
Yes, yes.
Right?
So, you know, like the guidance thing, you say that it could be done by talking and or like sending them to institutes or taking help from like, you know, teachers or relatives. So, but self-control, would it just work by talking to them or are there other ways? Because it's something that you have to train yourself to do.
Yeah, that's right. I was coming up to that.
Yes.
I wanted to say that when you guide them,
mm-hmm.
you need to be a role model. It goes
mm-hmm.
without saying.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to them, I mean 100% benefits of talking.
Okay.
So, of course, that role modeling process should be there from first.
Mm-hmm.
But then extra guidance should be also given by talking to them, reminding mm-hmm. them,
true.
Reinforcing it, making them follow up,
yeah.
you know, letting them not forget about the matter altogether. So you need to be a good role model so that they can catch quickly.
True, yes.
So of course for these things like controlling self-control,
mm.
you need to control your anger so that they can see how to control your anger, one's anger.
True.
You need to have a healthy relationship with everyone and not feel jealous about things that they need to see it, that, you know,
so that they can comprehend. Otherwise, it would be too difficult for them to comprehend.
Exactly. Yes. They can't get the picture.
Because they see something else in action and something else in speech.
That's right.
Which might
be confusing.
It confuses
them altogether, yeah. So it's good to give them a clear picture that, look, I'm the first one to have these characters of not showing jealousy, not being angry, so the child will immediately catch it.
Mm.
Okay, so to self-control is very important.
Yes.
So it's wrong for parents to give in every demand of the child
or
to allow him to vent his anger when he was, whenever he feels like.
Mm.
You know, it is part of training to help a child deal with disappointment and failure.
Mm. So you have to show him ways on how to deal with it rather than just letting him, you know, feel it's okay to do what he's doing.
Yeah, no, it's part of the growing up process to deal with how you come up with failure and disappointment.
Uh-huh,
as
okay.
it's normal. These ups and downs happen in life, you know.
Mm.
So if, for example, sometimes you face a loss or sometimes you don't get what you want, it's like how you deal with him would make him grow and make him wiser and make him feel, more, it'll make him more successful, in fact.
Yeah.
Because every time you don't get what you want,
this
makes him self-control.
Yeah. So we even have to show him that his anger is not right all the time. Like, just because he hasn't got something doesn't mean it's okay for him to be angry. Like,
it's
part of life.
Yeah. No, you need to teach him in the process that, you know, that this is how to deal with it. That if you're angry, like, there are many ways to deal with it.
All right. Okay, let's take a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the aspects of training children, and we were talking about self-control and how we should teach the kids to control themselves, control their desires, their wants, so, you know, and that they don't get everything in life always.
Yeah.
So they have to know how to deal with it,
yeah.
and that would come by the guidance of the parents.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, with this self-control, they can learn the aspect of taqwa also.
Mm.
Taqwa is very important to teach, you know.
Okay.
But this self-control from a young age teaches them more about how to have taqwa. in life. Yeah, yeah, it's a big, it's an open example to them. It's the most clear example to them. If done from a young age, that you can't have everything that you want, and you have to learn to control your anger, and you know you have to feel happy for the people who have more than you, for example. You know, all this is that a shield in you to control yourself.
Yes.
Self-control is one of the biggest aspects of our religion, to have taqwa, piety, faith, you know.
Yes.
So, and everything comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, inshallah, if a parent is serious about this, then he will see a lot of changes in the child growing up with that taqwa. And then you can, of course, theoretically tell the child that this is what our religion is all about.
Yeah.
Because taqwa comes habituated first. It has to be given good habits, inculcated good habits, and then it forms into that taqwa, right?
Yes, true. That's like the Holy Prophet when he came, before he actually mentioned the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he actually showed it by his actions first. That's when the people could accept it very, like...
open-handedly and faster.
Yes.
Because they saw it so clear in him, right?
Yes.
So that's how they will see that self-control in them. So then there's another aspect also, that whilst you're training your child, notice that you need to pay close attention to the change you need to bring about in life. Change.
What do you mean
so,
by that?
So, with this, I mean, although it's true that children inherit traits, okay? Such as sometimes, you know, a child may be shy, sometimes a child may fear easily, or sometimes a child may be so rowdy in character. But it's not true that these things cannot be changed.
Okay, so you say that change is possible in...
Yeah, in training of a child, you know, there's this social environment factor, there's this genetic factor, and then there is this will, your own will. That's the most powerful factor, that how your own will decides to. If you do irada and you want a change in yourself, then of course the change will come about. So... parents need to bear in mind that, of course, my children probably have this kind of genes in them, you know, that they're all maybe shy or they're introvert, or maybe they don't want to learn much, or they're more to do with fighting.
So we just think, oh, he's gone on his dad.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's not how to derive a conclusion from, you know, the way upbringing is done. No, we can always, always strive for change. Good training can help a child overcome certain characteristics that could hamper his progress in life, you know. Like parents need to first assess what negative traits are present in the child, and then plan how to overcome them. And then useful things to include discussions with the child, to read or narrate stories for them when people overcome these behaviors, and always encouraging the child to be better than what he is.
Yes.
You're always encouraging that you can be better. And for
but
example,
making sure not to.
Yeah, that's right. You have to always draw the line there.
Yes, because sometimes we overdo it and then actually make them feel that they're not good enough or something.
Or maybe you over encourage them so much that they feel that they need only that encouragement.
So there has to be that
as
balance.
An incentive. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sister Salma Khalfan. Inshallah, we'll continue in the next episode. And thank you very much for joining us on this program, dear listeners. If you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
European News Bulletin. Hello, everyone. My name is Saeed Pourreza. Our top story.
Iran has lambasted the silence of the International Atomic Energy Agency in the face of the murder of its nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, wrote a letter to the agency demanding a clear and unequivocal condemnation of last week's terrorist attack. He went on to urge the IAEA to end the process of unnecessarily publishing detailed information about Iranian locations and scientists, acts which he explained have led to the assassination of Iranian scientists in the past. The letter comes a day after the U.S. announced new sanctions on the Islamic Republic. The Trump administration's policy on Tehran is widely seen as an attempt to inflict maximum damage on the country and to destroy any attempt by the incoming Biden administration to repair the U.S.-Iran ties. Well, let's cross over to Pomo Lesgi, who is in Vienna, to tell us more about this story. And Homa, it's good to see you. Hope all is well. This was a brazen terrorist attack anyway you slice it. Why do you think the IAEA is mincing its words condemning it?
Yes, Saeed. Well, we have to first refer to an interview that Mr. Grossi, Rafael Mariano Grossi, the director general of the agency, had earlier with a news agency. And in that interview, when he was asked about this attack, the words he used were, and if I'm, if I should quote that clearly, let me say that we abhor violence of any type. We are an international organization for peace and security. So that's the only thing he said about this terrorist attack. And what the Iranian ambassador here to the agency, Mr. Gharibabadi, says in his letter is basically that this kind, this is not what the condemnation that Iran is looking for. This is not the type of attention that the international community should pay to what's happening when it comes to the sabotage attempts against, he says, Iran's nuclear facilities, as well as the threats that Iranian scientists or nuclear experts and those who are working in the nuclear industry are facing. And then he refers to the 2010, 2011, and 2012 assassinations of nuclear scientists in Iran. Mm-hmm. And he says that he believes that the IAEA, since it is at the moment in charge of the most robust verification activities in Iran, has a responsibility to completely, as you say there, clearly, unconditionally, basically renounce this terrorist act and stand with Iran against it, something that Iran says the agency is not doing.
Right. As you say, Iran has spoken its mind, hasn't it? So far we have seen the promise of a harsh response, demands for unequivocal condemnation of the assassination, and a vote by MPs for inspections to stop. Where do you think Iran's cooperation with the IAEA is headed?
Well, at the moment, as far as the agency itself is concerned, Mr. Grossi has said that he hasn't received any kind of signal or he hasn't seen any indication that Iran wants to reduce its current level of cooperation with the agency. And Iran also hasn't actually said that it is going to do so. But as mentioned in various statements by Mr. Gharibabadi in his addresses to the IAEA Board of Governors, Iran has that as an option on the table and will have it as an option because Iran has said that at the moment it is continuing to cooperate with the agency, but if it reaches the conclusion that the confidentiality is not going to be preserved, then this could actually affect the level of cooperation. I'll just quickly add here, Saeed, if I can, just in the past half hour, we had another tweet by Mr. Gharibabadi in which he said that he was criticizing the fact that another report by the agency concerning a confidential letter by Iran to the agency has been leaked to the press again just today. And he was saying in that tweet that he believes that this is against the confidentiality agreement that Iran and the agency have and that the agency should try and form a means of communication where confidential contents of letters or information regarding Iran's nuclear activities is not leaked to the press immediately, he says, even before members of the board themselves can track it down.
Right. And let's also talk about the nuclear deal and this idea, the indication that Joe Biden, the incoming president, will return to the JCPOA. We're yet to see that happen, though. But one thing we know is that in the past, the toughest sanctions on Iran were imposed by the Democrats, from Jimmy Carter in the 1970s to Clinton in the 1990s and all the rest of them. What are the odds of Biden being any different?
Yes, in fact, I do remember that when the sides were signing the nuclear agreement or were getting near conclusion when it came to the nuclear agreement in 2015, the Obama administration still made these statements that it was because of these increased pressure and sanctions that Iran actually was forced to come to the negotiation table and agree to this nuclear deal. When it comes to the Biden administration, at the moment, the administration has said that if Iran goes back to full compliance to the nuclear deal, then the Biden administration would be ready to come back to the nuclear agreement. But that, you know, on the ground, we're not sure how that's going to work out, because Iran, on the other hand, has said it will, you know, go back to its previous full compliance once the other sides meet their commitments, once sanctions are lifted. So it's going to be also about who's going to go first, and if that is going to happen, is there going to be a situation where both sides can be sure that this is going to work and the JCPOA can survive?
Right. Well, it's only a matter of time, Homa. We'll have to wait and see. Homa Lesgi in Vienna for us. Nice speaking with you. To other news now, an update in the case of a 12-year-old British Somali girl who drowned in a river in Manchester in June 2019. A coroner has concluded Shukri Abdi's death was an accident. Ahmed Kabbala was at the inquest and sent us this.
So we've just come out of the coroner's court, where after a 39-page report that took roughly an hour and a half, the coroner reached her conclusion that the death of Shukri Abdi was an accidental death and not the result of criminal negligence or manslaughter. Now, she did suggest that Child One did have a duty of care to Shukri Abdi, and that by leading Shukri Abdi into deep water, into a river, when she knew that Shukri Abdi could not swim, and letting go of her hand and allegedly pushing her away, she did fail in her duty of care. However, this did not result in criminal negligence, because the child was in unfamiliar water in a part of the river that she had not been before. Now, many people will analyse the court case, will analyse the police reaction to it, and they will make the conclusions that Shukri Abdi was a black Muslim refugee, and because of that, the due diligence wasn't taken by the officers at the time in investigating this case. Now, that wasn't discussed today in the court, but it will be discussed by campaigners that have raised the flag and raised the case and the profile of the Shukri Abdi case. And I have a feeling that this case, this profile, the Justice for Shukri Abdi campaign will continue, because they feel that justice hasn't been served today and that the family has not received justice, despite the coroner's conclusion, in which he essentially told the family to move on and remember Shukri Abdi for the girl that she is, instead of the way that she died.
Well, the inquiry into Shukri Abdi's death was forced by a public campaign given momentum by the Black Lives Matter movement. The little girl's family have said they'd continue to fight the case in the courts. We spoke with the family's lawyer, who complained of institutional racism during the investigation.
Institutional racism in this country takes many forms. And in these sorts of cases, what you often see is a situation where either complaints are not taken seriously, brushed under the carpet, and that has been the family's position throughout from the beginning, that the police were not listening to them. There was a real struggle for their voices to be heard. But then when you speak about voices being heard, you often, in the case of institutional racism, you see examples where an officer, for example, is speaking to a person from a black or minority ethnic background, and they shout at them. And you think, why are you shouting? It doesn't help for the person to understand. Your volume in voice doesn't mean they will understand you better. But that's what they do. Either they won't hear you, so you brush it under the carpet, or they will hear you, and you're shouting. So you can't win. And that, for me, is one of the backbones of institutional racism.
Still in this country, off the back of a second national lockdown and with the effects of COVID-19 still gripping the nation, health experts remain deeply concerned about the effects of the virus on Britain's BAME communities. This report by correspondent Richard Sedan.
Good afternoon. In
welcome to today's...
Earlier this year, Health Secretary Matt Hancock confirmed what many believed in saying that the government was concerned about the potential disproportionate impact on BAME communities of COVID. Indeed, BAME health workers working in the health service in the early days of the pandemic were some of the first to lose their lives on the front line treating those who had contracted the disease.
The lethal effects of COVID resulting in deaths and black and ethnic minority peoples. And that's hugely disproportionate for African descent peoples within that overall black and ethnic minority category. And yet this government has routinely refused to recognise that the consequence of institutionalised racism, enforced poverty, the ethnic pay gap that pushes black and ethnic minority workers into the lowest paid public sector, public-facing sector jobs, has resulted in them being overexposed to the vulnerability of COVID.
As well as concerns about structural inequalities impacting COVID, some have also raised concerns about the potential of some medical conditions within BAME communities being impacted by COVID.
There have been papers in the British Medical Journal alerting to the fact that certain blood pressure and diabetes medications do seem to cause, when there is an infection already, it's more likely to escalate into the disastrous lung problems that cause sudden death. So I know that there is a difference between Indigenous and BAME communities in this country as regards those problems.
Irrespective of continued debates over health issues within BAME communities, the impact of COVID on those communities due to existing structural inequality is to many undeniable.
We've seen with Belly Malinga and others here in the United Kingdom, a rail worker who was spat upon who later died of COVID, and the doctors overwhelmingly Asian and African, the nurses overwhelmingly African and Asian that have died as a consequence of COVID being brutally ignored by this government, who are now suggesting that it's down to black people and Asian people's lifestyles why they are more vulnerable to COVID rather than the brutal realities of institutionalised racism.
As the effects of COVID continue to grip the nation, many people remain deeply concerned about the devastating impact of COVID on some of the country's most marginalised communities. Although the debate continues, many medical experts believe that COVID-19 disproportionately affects BAME communities already dealing with inequalities within the health service, leading many to ask the question, what do decision makers intend to do about those inequalities? Richard Sudam, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Former Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat is facing a public inquiry into the murder of journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was killed in a bomb blast near her home in 2017. Activists and the political opposition say Muscat protected people linked to the murder. Muscat, who stepped down as Prime Minister in January this year, denies any wrongdoing. The former PM has close ties to several people under criminal investigation for Galizia's murder. The victim was an acclaimed investigative reporter who made a career exposing rampant corruption, cronyism, nepotism, and organized crime in Maltese politics. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he hoped France would get rid of what he called the Macron trouble very soon. Speaking to reporters, the president described the French leader as a burden on France, who has led the nation into a very dangerous period. The Turkish leader's comments come just a day after France announced it would be launching a massive and unprecedented attack on 76 mosques deemed to be extremist by the government's controversial definition of Islamic extremism. Erdogan has previously stated that his French counterpart needed a mental check for his separatist attitudes on Muslims. thousands of Armenians have taken to the capital Yerevan, blocking major roads and bringing traffic to a standstill in the latest round of demonstrations to hit the country. They're calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, over a ceasefire deal they say prematurely locked in Azeri territorial gains in the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh last month. The PM says the deal was a disaster, but it staved off a large-scale defeat. Despite a coalition of 17 opposition parties naming a potential caretaker prime minister to replace him, Pashinyan is refusing to step down, saying he is now responsible for ensuring national security and stabilizing Armenia. As Brexit negotiations reach their conclusion, ministers in the UK and leaders throughout the EU will be keen to unpick all the other details, as the threat of no deal remains a real possibility. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, some in the EU may in fact favor a no-deal scenario.
Good morning.
Open up.
A deal is imminent. These are the latest murmurings to leak from the Brexit negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union. As we approach the 11th hour, differences remain, but the reality of the circumstances are becoming ever clearer.
We are negotiating, and of course I follow closely the process of negotiation, but we will see in the next hours or in the next days what will be on the table, and we will need to assess the situation. And this will be a question at the end of the negotiation. We need to decide, the member states, they will need to decide. Like the British side, we will need to say yes or no. And the member states will say yes or no.
If progress is made, all 27 member states have to agree and ratify the deal in the European Parliament. France, however, have been very vocal. If the deal does not suit them, they will veto the agreement and send both sides into a no-deal outcome.
France is committed to our interests. We need to prepare ourselves for a no deal, meaning that on December 31st, we would no longer have free movement and free access to the British market, and vice versa. But that's not what we desire. Negotiations are continuing as we speak, but I also want to tell our fishermen, our companies, and our citizens we will not accept a bad deal. If the deal does not correspond with our interests, we will oppose it.
While many see such sentiments as negotiating tactics, some believe France actually wants a no-deal outcome. Economically, they will be affected, but it will be the UK that will feel the impact the hardest. France still has free trade with Europe and all nations that have trade agreements with the Union. The UK, however, will be limited to World Trade Organization tariffs. In this way, a no-deal outcome gives France the opportunity to fill the void left by the UK, who will find themselves increasingly isolated. A no-deal can also lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom. This will significantly impact the global standing of Westminster, who have recently been overtaken by India in the global order of world economies. Economic forecasts put the UK at the bottom of the G7, with the pandemic having impacted the UK economy more than its neighbours. In this vein, a deal that will protect jobs and livelihoods is now more vital than sentiment and ideology.
Coming up in this segment, another example of Israeli soldiers committing violence against Palestinians and getting away with it. The case of a Palestinian boy shot in the eye with a rubber bullet in February. Let's bring in Robert Enlakesh with all the latest details. Robert.
Well, before we get into this, an update from the West Bank. A Palestinian 12-year-old child has just been shot and killed. That's another update on their violence that they're using against Palestinians. This case that we're looking at here was actually thrown out of an Israeli court when it was investigated. The then 8-year-old boy, Malik Issa, was shot in the head by an Israeli police officer in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. There were multiple eyewitnesses to this. There was an investigation into the evidence of what he was struck with. However, the Israeli forces claimed that they had shot at a wall and not shot at the child. Of course, again, this runs contrary to all the claims of the eyewitnesses, but because the eyewitnesses are Palestinian, they're thrown out. And this case was thrown out of court, not investigating the Israelis who shot this innocent, now 9-year-old boy. His parents came out with a statement saying there is no justice in this world. So, unfortunately, another case of Israel yet again getting away with its terrorist attacks on children.
There is no justice in this world, as you say, quoting Maliki's family. How has social media reacted to this story?
The first comment we have here is from a Twitter account called Princess Warrior, who says, "Recent news on the Palestinian child medic Isa, 9 years old, who was shot in the eye by an Israeli terrorist. He was with his two younger sisters when this happened, and where's the terrorist shooter? Roaming around in all freedom, completely unpunished, face with symbols over mouth. BDS, ICC for Israel," as the two hashtags there. We got another one here as well from an account called Illuminati Killer, who says, "This is what infuriates me. Meanwhile, Washington makes Israel look like the good guys. Nothing to see here, just pay your taxes and don't ask where that money's going or what it's for."
And Robert, these killings are happening quite regularly. I think it was the day before yesterday, was it? We reported on the other young man who was shot by the Israeli soldiers, and they denied that they had done that.
Absolutely. These sort of denials come frequently after their terrorist attacks on innocent Palestinian civilians. Of course, the attack that we reported on a few days ago was in Jerusalem al-Quds. This attack here was today, which just occurred, was on a 12-year-old Palestinian named Ali. He was shot in the stomach with live ammunition. And again, no one is going to have to pay for this. No one's going to go to prison for this. I can guarantee you that. And unfortunately, the case that we're looking at here as well of Malik, he's lost his eye, and no one's going to pay for that either.
No one's going to pay for it. And of course, you're going to keep us updated on that breaking story of the Palestinian, young Palestinian shot dead in the past hour or so. Let's move on to your second story. The U.S. has accused China of being the greatest threat to democracy and freedom. And that, of course, comes 2 months after China accused the U.S. of being the greatest threat to global strategic security and stability. Fill us in.
Well, China's claim actually has a little bit of truth to that, whereas the United States just coming with its traditional my freedoms, my liberty, and all the rest of it, which it, you know, constantly goes around the world carrying the flag and the banner of freedom and liberty and of being, you know, operating as a democracy, yet it acts with complete impunity around the world, sanctions countries, commits war crimes, military coups, is the only country to actually have used a nuclear weapon on innocent civilians in the cases of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And it goes around the world trying to lecture other countries. What we're seeing here is the development into a new Cold War. The United States is using the likes of Australia, for instance, as its sort of attack dog, especially in the South China Sea as well. And on top of that, what we're seeing is this sort of developing situation where the United States is attempting to isolate China. So it will be interesting to see what they do when Joe Biden comes in, whether he'll take the same line as Trump, he'll pursue a trade war with China, or whether he's going to try and engage with China, because China has built its place on this earth with diplomacy, not with bullets. Unfortunately, the United States of America, since World War II, has been doing all of its diplomacy with bullets and bombs rather than trade relationships.
And we may want to throw into the mix the Blackwater security firm and what they did in Afghanistan, and of course the scandal at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Bring us the online reaction to this briefly.
First comment we have here says, "The U.S. has the cheek to call China the biggest threat to freedom, lol. Says the country currently engaged in so many wars for corporate profit that we no longer can count." Another one here as well from a user called Tom, who says, "Here's what the title of this story should really read. U.S. mad at China, so it blames it of trying to do some of the bad things the U.S. already does. The morons could read an Onion piece on this and still think it's true." Quoting my freedoms, hashtag
war. My freedoms, my freedoms. I think that's how it should be read. All right, Robert in Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you very much. And that does it for this broadcast from London. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. lecture.
Sheikh Asad Ja'fari.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Lessons from the life of Nabi Musa alayhi salam has been our topic. We have been looking at the story of Nabi Musa alayhi salam through the lens of the Quran. We mentioned to all of you a few nights ago that Nabi Musa is that Musa that is the most mentioned of all the prophets inside the Quran. 900 plus verses across 30 different surahs about this man. And it's important that we look at these realities from the Book of Allah. And I've asked all of you, and alhamdulillah, the feedback I'm getting is very good, and I'm very happy to hear back from all of you, that all of you are sitting around now with your families, inshallah, with the Quran now in front of you, in some form, be it a phone or be it a book or something, so we can follow along. As I said, there is only one prophet, being Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam, whose entire story from start to finish is reported in one surah, being Surah Yusuf, obviously. Nabi Musa's story is bits and pieces here, chunks of verses here, another chunk over there. So we'll initially tell you the next portion of the story, and then we'll look at the various verses along with all of you to see how the Quran describes all of this. We left off yesterday's discussion, where now the mother of Nabi Musa, the Old Testament refers to her as Jokabid. The Arabic is Yukabid. But the Quran refers to her as Umme Musa, the mother of Musa. There's no name given. We mentioned how she gave birth to this newborn son at a time where there was a command from Fir'aun to kill all newborn babies born from the Bani Israel tribe, due to the fact that his dream was prophesied to mean that his kingdom will be demolished or destroyed by this savior who will come from the Levi tribe of the Bani Israel, dating all the way back to Nabi Yaqub alayhi salam. So he thought, let me go ahead and be a little proactive, and let me go ahead and, target these newborn boys only from the Bani Israel tribe. So he had a midwife. The midwife was asked to report of any newborn males to two soldiers. They would on the spot kill that newborn baby boy. When Nabi Musa was born, the midwife was so taken by him, so in love with him, that she refused to tell the soldiers that a boy was born. Instead, made up some excuse about a miscarriage, even showed some blood on a cloth, some reports say. And in the meantime, in the process, protected Nabi Musa's existence. And then, of course, at that moment, a wahi comes down, or she's inspired the mother of Nabi Musa, and the Quran refers to wahina ila umme Musa, wahi, or there was a revelation, or we revealed to Musa's mother, the mother of Musa, to place this newborn child in a basket, in what's called a tabut, and put it inside the Nile River. Okay. The Quran now gives a little bit of a spoiler alert, for lack of a better word, where now the Quran says that he will eventually end up at a place where he, at the doorstep of his enemy and my enemy, me of course being Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he will be amongst the prophets. So we left a last night's episode at the fact that the mother now had let go of the basket, and the basket now is flowing down the river. Okay, let's continue the story from there. We jump to Bibi Asiya and the kingdom of Fir'aun. Now, Fir'aun had married Asiya knowing full well that she was an Israeli. Okay, she was from the Bani Israel tribe. She was, of course, a pious woman from a pious lineage. And one of the reasons we have in our books, one possible reason why he would marry a member from the Bani Israel tribe, and this was fairly common back then, that sometimes one individual would marry a woman from another tribe to bring the tribes together, or to possibly soften the amount of zulm that one does onto that other tribe, right? So possibly to distract, to soften, to kind of overlook the zulm he's doing on the Bani Israel tribe, he married this woman. Now what he thought from Asiya was that his lineage through a boy would move forward and the kingdom would be passed on to him. But she was barren. She couldn't have any children, Asiya. Okay? So now, of course, this basket is in the river. Now let's jump the scene to Asiya. Now, in one report it says that Asiya was enjoying the weather one day, and her and a couple of her friends inside of the palace, she had asked Fir'aun that, I want to go outside and enjoy the weather. Can you put a canopy or some sort of a tent outside so I can enjoy the weather by the river, by the water. So he does that, and she's out there, and she's enjoying the weather. And what is spotted in the distance is this basket, okay? This treasure, this box, however you want to refer to it. The Quran says, "Tabu."